It's time to wake to sleep with Sleep Science Today, where we learn to sleep well with your host, Andrew Kolsky, on UK Health Radio.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Sleep Science Today. Like we say, sleep science today and sleep better tonight. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky. I'm happy to announce I have a new book out, which is called Why Can't I Sleep Well? You can find that on my website at sleepsciencetoday.com. Today, we're going to be talking about sleep and dermatology. An interesting combination. Our guest is Dr. Tina Butani. She is the owner and CEO of Synergy Dermatology in San Francisco. So welcome, Dr. Butani.
Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you here. And I will apologize to the audience in advance if you hear my voice cracking a little bit. I'm just getting over laryngitis, but the show must go on. All right. So I think, you know, the introduction itself is interesting enough to get people's attention. Skin health, dermatology, and then sleep. They seem very, very different. How did you get into the area where you're dealing with these two seemingly different topics?
Yeah, I know. I get that all the time. It's like, why are you talking about sleep? But I'm a medical dermatologist, but I specialize in inflammatory skin conditions, mainly diseases like psoriasis and eczema, which actually plague, many, many people, millions of people in the United States. And I really became interested in this topic because I once had a patient with psoriasis who I was having a really hard time treating. You know, we had tried many different therapies, many different options, and his skin just wasn't clearing. And one day he walked in my door with almost crystal clear skin. And I asked him, what did he do? What was the difference? And he told me, he said, Dr. Butani, I stopped sleeping with my wife. I kind of like paused and was like, okay, this might be a longer conversation. But when I got back to it, it turns out that his wife had actually been diagnosed with sleep apnea. And so she started sleeping in a separate room because, she now had a CPAP machine. Mm-hmm. And unbeknownst to him, for the past many years, her sleep apnea had actually been waking him up. And so he was having kind of highly fragmented sleep, even though he didn't have a diagnosed skin disorder. And once he started getting more of that kind of restorative sleep again, his skin disease actually started to improve. And so he asked me the question. He said, is there any connection between sleep and psoriasis? And to be completely honest, I didn't know the answer to it. I said, I don't know, but I'll go and do some research. And when I did, I found out, surprisingly, that there was a total lack of research in this space, not only in psoriasis, but in dermatology in general. There was a few studies out there, but not a lot of focus on sleep and skin. But when I looked at other fields like rheumatology or gastroenterology, which also treat a lot of inflammatory skin diseases, there's a lot of work in those fields. And so I was able to make some corollaries from different diseases that, have similar mechanisms. But that's kind of how I got interested in this. And so I decided that, I could try to fill this gap and create some data around sleep and skin.
Wow, that's kind of interesting how that came about. So,
yeah.
So am I hearing you right that really for this particular patient you were talking about, there wasn't any medicine, that was applied? It was purely he started getting good sleep.
Yeah. No, I mean, he was on background treatment. We have had him on stable treatment for a long time. So he'd gotten his skin to a better place than it was before, but he still had these stubborn spots on his skin, stubborn rashes that we really had a hard time dealing with. And then when he started to get better sleep, those kind of stubborn areas started to improve even more, even though we hadn't changed any of his background therapies.
Wow. Okay. So you mentioned inflammatory skin diseases.
Yes.
So just, for our purposes here, because we're all new to this, What would be common inflammatory skin diseases that people might have?
Yeah. So, you know, first of all, the skin is the body's largest organ. So I think that's something that people don't really think about. When we think of organs, we're thinking liver, kidney, you know, heart, things like that.
Right,
but the
right.
skin is itself an organ, and it's the body's largest organ. And it's actually a very large part of our immune system, actually. So when we dig into the skin, we have a lot of different immune cells, a lot of different immune mechanisms that are going on in the skin. So when patients get, for example, autoimmune conditions, they oftentimes present on the skin. Things like lupus, for example, can present with, you know, a skin rash on the face or other autoimmune conditions. The other thing that can happen is you can get increased, you know, inflammation on the skin. And sometimes it's autoimmune, but sometimes we don't actually know quite what the triggers are, so we can't really call it autoimmune. But what we do know is that there's increased inflammation in the skin. And when that happens, it leads to different skin diseases. So I mentioned psoriasis. I mentioned eczema. Those are probably the two more common ones. But even mm-hmm. things like acne, rosacea, those are also, examples of inflammatory skin conditions and diseases where there's too much inflammation going on in the skin. Those immune cells, those immune mechanisms are a little bit too active. And it's our job to kind of, you know, bring them back to normal.
Got it. Okay, so I want to break those down a little bit so that we can identify. In other words, if someone is listening to the show and they're thinking they may have something going on from a dermatological perspective, I wrote down, you mentioned psoriasis, eczema, acne, rosacea, all are things that might be, you know, from inflammatory skin issues.
Yeah. I mean, there's whole list. There's vitiligo, hidradenitis, you know, I could go on and on, lichen planus. There's lots of different, you know, most of our skin diseases, you know, diagnosable skin diseases, a large proportion of them are due to inflammation.
Got it. So of some of the more, well-known, I would think, like psoriasis is pretty well-known, eczema is, acne is, rosacea, even to a degree, is probably pretty well-known. But, you know, I have to admit, I wouldn't know the difference between psoriasis or eczema or, or you know, any of the others. Can you give us a breakdown? Like, how would someone know if they had psoriasis versus eczema versus something else?
Yeah. So, you know, there's rashes, and then there's diseases that present a little bit differently than rashes. So, for example, acne presents with more kind of like pimples and bumps on the face or the back or the chest. And, you know, rosacea presents with redness on the skin. So those aren't necessarily rashes per se. But then when we get into the rashy diseases like psoriasis, eczema, to be honest, sometimes it's very difficult to differentiate it, even for a dermatologist. You know, sometimes we're not able to just look at it and tell you what it is. But just, you know, high level, psoriasis is a rash. It usually presents on the elbows and knees with these like red scaly plaques. It can also affect scalp. Really any part of the body, actually hands and feet, can be affected by psoriasis. Psoriasis most commonly, not always, most commonly presents a little later in life, so usually kind of in the 30s or so. And a lot of times patients will have a family history of psoriasis because we think there's a genetic component there. Eczema, on the other hand, can really present anywhere on the body. And the rashes on the skin are not as discreet as psoriasis. So with psoriasis, you can say, like, this is normal skin, this is psoriasis skin, it's very clear. With eczema, the lines are a little bit more blurred. It kind of just looks like dry skin. And then the areas where there's rashes will look, you know, a little red, scaly, sometimes scratched up because it's a very itchy disease. And with eczema, it usually oftentimes starts at a younger age. So a lot of times, you know, children will present with eczema. And many times, though, they might outgrow their eczema, but other times they go on to continue to have it as an adult. But we're also learning about types of eczema where they only start in adulthood, and somebody might not have, you know, eczema when they were younger. But again, there's oftentimes a family history of either eczema or asthma, seasonal allergies, food allergies, because we think that these are actually kind of interrelated diseases. But, you know, to be honest, the right answer to that question is you should really try to see a board-certified dermatologist and have them assess your skin, because it happens all the time where people think they have one disease and they come in and see me and I'm like, oh, that's not actually what you have. So, so it's really great to try to get to see your dermatologist.
Right. So it kind of sounds like if it's itchy, and red and puffy. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Those might be three key factors that say go see the dermatologist.
Yes, exactly. If you have skin that's difficult to control, if it's, you know, symptomatic in any way, if you have visible skin, you know, things, rashes, lesions going on, these are all indications that you can come in to see a dermatologist.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. So, you know, it's interesting. I'm going to ask you this question. I already know the answer, but I speak to so many different people, whether they be medical doctors or whether they're mental health professionals or whatever it may be, and we talk about their schooling. And, you know, as you were training for your career, what did they teach you and how did it go? And then we get to the question, did they ever teach you anything in school about sleep? And I'm curious to hear from you, when you went to medical school, did you ever learn anything about sleep?
Yeah, I don't think I did. Yeah, I think, you know, probably in medical school, we talked a little bit about obstructive sleep apnea. I think maybe, can't remember if it was a neurology rotation or, you know, which rotation it was, but I remember learning about that a little bit. But yeah, definitely in derm residency, there was no mention of sleep during my entire training there. But even medical school, I'm surprised actually now that you say it, it was pretty limited.
Yeah, and that's you know, that's why I said I already know the answer, because I've never had anybody tell me, oh yeah, we definitely, you know, learned about sleep and how it impacts all the different issues that we were dealing with. Never had that answer yet.
Yeah, but you know, it's funny, it's the same with dermatology, because actually in most medical school, dermatology is like a 1 week block that most students go through. So unless you go on to want to become a dermatologist and get more thorough training, most primary care docs, most, you know, other specialties really don't feel comfortable with dermatology because there's very limited training during medical school.
Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah.
It is interesting, you know, because this particular radio show is all around the world. I've had the opportunity to speak to people in different countries. And one of the things that I have learned, which I did not know, is apparently when you get over into the UK, for example, I have been told by doctors there that the questions about sleep is just a standard, one of the first things even your primary care physician is going to be asking about. I guess they just have a very different approach. You know, the way they do it over there. So it is interesting, because I've, you know, look, I live in the U.S. and I don't think I've ever been asked about sleep, even when I go for a physical or anything.
Yeah, totally. I mentioned, you know, when I looked into the research around psoriasis and sleep, and then, you know, there were a few studies that had been done. Actually, all of those studies were done out of the UK, so it's interesting that you bring that up, because I think, yeah, the little work that has been done, it's all almost predominantly been out of the UK.
Right. Wow. So now that you have started to kind of address that issue and you've made that link in your own head, are you aware of any colleagues or other dermatologists that you know about who are sort of making that connection?
Yeah, I think so. You know, first of all, I'm trying to get the word out there. So, you know, I give a lot of talks around this topic. So I think, you know, I'm trying to educate my colleagues. But there actually are a number of dermatologists who are really interested in what we call integrative dermatology. So really just taking a more holistic approach to treating skin diseases. You know, my good friends, Dr. Peter Leo, he's in Chicago. He's a very well-known integrative dermatologist. And Dr. Raja Sivamani, who's here in Sacramento in California. Both of them are very well known in the field for kind of, trying to take that more whole body approach to treating skin disease.
Wow. Okay. So when you talk whole body approach, do you mean like the foods that we eat and other things as well?
Yeah, exactly. You know, again, skin is the body's largest organ. And so we need to, in order for our skin to be healthy, we need to make sure our body is healthy. And so those are definitely things that we try to discuss.
Got it. Okay. So if I'm a patient of yours, you're going to talk to me about not only sleep, but what I'm eating, what I'm doing, you know, my whole existence, I'm guessing.
Yeah, we try. I mean, you know, we have in dermatology, we have 10 or 15 minute visits. And so we always can't do it in one, you know, one visit, but I try to make it a thing, you know, where each time a patient comes back, we're trying to talk about, you know, a different aspect of their health, and making sure that, you know, we touch upon it. You know, the thing about dermatology patients is I get to know them over time. You know, they come back every year for their skin check, or if they have a skin disease, I'm seeing them every few months. So we have, you know, over the course of their lifetime, we have a lot of opportunities to educate.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Great. Yeah. Great. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, let me, this is a good point for us to take a break, and we're going to do a commercial break here. And when we come back, we'll continue our conversation. So this is Sleep Science Today. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky. We'll take a break, and we'll come back with Dr. Tina Butani.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Okay, welcome back to Sleep Science Today. We've been talking about sleep and how it impacts our skin health with Dr. Tina Butani. So let's talk about consequences of chronic poor sleep on skin health versus somebody who maybe just didn't sleep well last night. So, you know, I'll phrase it this way. I know for myself, if I wake up and I really didn't sleep well, I'm pretty much going to see it on my face and in my skin, different from someone who may have a chronic disease. So can you help us understand what we would expect to see in each of those cases?
Yeah. So I think that was the perfect example. So short-term sleep loss, we're going to see things like, you know, your skin just doesn't look as shiny or maybe as lustrous, you know, as you're used to seeing it. Maybe the color is kind of, you know, taken out of your skin. You might feel dry. Your skin might feel, you know, just a little unhealthy. And like you said, you know, most patients can kind of feel like, oh man, you know, I need a little more lotion today or something else is going on my skin. Versus, you know, chronic sleep disturbance. With chronic sleep disturbance, not only do you get those changes, but there are actually some studies to show that with chronic sleep disturbance, you can actually speed up skin aging, for example. So there was one study which looked at good sleepers and poor sleepers more chronically. And when they had dermatologists rate their ages, the poor sleepers actually consistently were scored as being older because they start to, you know, start to notice their wrinkles, you know, maybe they have those dark circles under their eyes. So those things were, you know, continue to come up. We also know that with chronic sleep disturbance, potentially we can increase the presentation of those skin diseases that I talked about earlier. So, you know, there's not great studies there making the connections, but we definitely know there's an association between chronic poor sleep and having, you know, skin diseases. So those are other things that can come up. So mm-hmm. It's not just about your skin looking pretty. It actually can become, you know, a medical diagnosable condition.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned those things. I was just doing some reading last night, and I came across some of the studies related to looking older mm-hmm. because you don't have good sleep. And I found that to be really interesting. And there is research out there that shows, you know, that this is an issue. So let's say someone comes in as a patient to your office and whatever presenting issue doesn't really matter. But the point is you see their overall skin and you can see, you know, their age and then you see their skin. What would you, let me ask you this way. What would you normally expect the skin on the face of like a 40-year-old to look like versus what are some cases, if any, that you've seen where that looks very different than what you would expect?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit of a difficult question because, you know, genetics also play a huge role in the appearance of some skin. And I think, you know, we can all relate. You see some 40-year-olds and they might look like they're what we think a 20-year-old should look like, right? Their skin is pristine, no wrinkles, no sunspots, you know, anything like that. And then there's 40-year-olds that might look, you know, older than that. So I think it's more than just the appearance of the skin. But when patients talk to me and they tell me that they feel their skin is not what it used to be. And so I have to take their baseline, you know, like my skin used to look like this and now it looks like this. And usually that conversation comes up because they're asking me about skincare, right? They're like, what lotions should I be using? Which serums should I be using? There's all these things on the shelves and nobody knows, you know, what the right thing is to use. So when that question comes up, when they feel like their skin is not what it used to be, that's when I start to have those conversations. Obviously, we're going to talk about skincare, sun protection, you know, really staying out of the sun as much as possible can help with that aging. But also other things like diet and sleep, physical activity, even things like social connection. You know, there's been studies to show that even social connection, for example, can impact overall health and the way your skin looks. So I think that's when I start to have those larger conversations.
I see. Okay. And let me ask you this, and this may be sort of out of your wheelhouse or not, I don't know. When you see a client who's got like some of the inflammatory skin diseases that we've talked about, and you find out that they just say to you, you know, I'm just not sleeping well. Generally, I just don't sleep well. Now, I realize you're a dermatologist, you're not a sleep doctor, but have you ever been told by your patients, or have you found that there's any particular type of sleep issues that they mainly have?
Yeah, it's a great question. So the first thing I ask them is, you know, whether they think that sleep disturbance is related to their skin disease, right? So are they waking up in the middle of the night because they're itching or because they're feeling pain on their skin, or is there something else going on that's you know, causing them to wake up? And if the answer is yes, then it comes to me to try to, you know, be better about treating their skin disease. That tells me that their skin disease might not be completely controlled. If the answer is no, if they think it's, you know, unrelated to what's going on their skin, then we have to start to think about, you know, do you have insomnia? Do you have obstructive sleep apnea? You know, things like that. And so to answer your question about are there things that I see more often in patients with skin disease, there is a very strong association between obstructive sleep apnea and psoriasis. I think that is a very well-known association that we know about. And it's bidirectional. So basically, psoriasis patients are more likely to have obstructive sleep apnea, and patients with obstructive sleep apnea are actually more likely to have psoriasis. So it kind of goes in both directions. I think that's probably where most of our studies are around psoriasis and OSA. But there are smaller studies that also show a link to maybe like, you know, restless leg syndrome and, like I said, insomnia. Psoriasis is the most well-studied. Eczema, not so much, and other diseases, not so much. We don't have as much data there. But I think the answer is yes. We probably do have special patterns that we just don't know a lot about yet.
Wow, I didn't know that before. So studies have shown that there's a correlation of some sort between eczema and obstructive sleep apnea.
Psoriasis
and obstructive sleep apnea, sort of bidirectional. Is there, have you read any studies or does anyone have any idea whether there's a causation link there in any way?
Yeah, you know, I think this might be a good question for the sleep apnea docs, but my understanding is that there is some thoughts that obstructive sleep apnea, in addition to being a physical problem, you know, patients can't, you know, their neck size and, you know, things like that, that there might be an inflammatory piece there, that they actually have high levels of what we call Th17 inflammation, and that kind of feeds into the disease process. And interestingly enough, psoriasis is also a disease of, you know, elevated Th17 immune cells, and so there might be a connection there. But I think that might be a better question for the sleep docs.
Yeah, well, but it's interesting because I've never heard that, and I've been to, you know, many, 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 many presentations at different sleep conferences and, you know, learned a lot about obstructive sleep apnea and all those things, but I have never heard about that particular link. So I find that to be really fascinating.
It's actually even more important for our patients with psoriasis because psoriasis itself is a condition that increases your risk for things like cardiovascular disease, obesity, diabetes. And interestingly, that's also something that we see in patients with obstructive sleep apnea, right? That they have elevated, other health conditions. And so again, you know, I think that If you have both psoriasis and obstructive sleep apnea, then your risk might even be much higher. And so I think that's why it's really important to kind of recognize those things.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to have to do some more research into that myself. Yeah. I'm curious. So we're talking about that part. So what about when it comes to, again, comparing patients who come into your office? Some of them, you know, their skin looks better than others. And I realize there's all sorts of reasons why that could be. But in general, do you find that there's any connection, whether scientifically proven or just your observation, between what people are eating and their skin health?
Yeah, it's a good question. So a good example for, you know, is acne, for example. And there's some studies that show that eating, for example, high amounts of dairy, especially when it's things like skim milk or like highly processed dairy, that might trigger acne. Also eating foods that are high in saturated fats can sometimes trigger acne. So I think the answer is yes. Studying diet and skin is actually very complicated, though, because, you know, everybody's diets are so different across the board. It's really hard to, for example, design a clinical trial where everybody eats the exact same foods every single day, you know, and the same amount of food and things like that. It just wouldn't work. And so it gets very complicated with diets because there's so many other, you know, factors that are coming into play. But I think that there probably is certain connections with psoriasis, for example. We think that there are certain foods that are a little bit more pro-inflammatory. So again, those foods that are high in saturated fats, red meats, for example, can be pro-inflammatory. And then not eating enough like green leafy vegetables and you know, or eating too many like highly processed carbs. We think that those foods can be pro-inflammatory and could potentially worsen psoriasis. There was one study that showed that patients who eat more of what we call a Mediterranean diet, which is, you know, a really well-balanced diet with good fats and healthy carbs and lean meats, for example, that they tend to have less severe psoriasis versus, you know, patients who are eating unhealthy, more, I guess, quote-unquote American diets, that they tend to have more severe psoriasis. So there might be a link there.
Interesting. Excuse me. Yeah, because that's, you know, and I assume the conversation would be true whether we're talking sleep, skin, or any other medical condition. Yeah, but the, absolutely. you know, the more we can stay towards the outside aisles of the grocery store where the fresh vegetables and fruits and meats and cheeses are, versus the center aisles, which are all the processed, preservative laden type of foods. You know, I find that interesting too. Like when I go over to Europe, if you go into a grocery store in Europe, they're, at least the ones I've been to, are nowhere near the size of what we have here in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And the difference is that they have a lot of the fresh fruits, vegetables, meats, cheeses, all those things, and a much smaller center aisle with any type of preserved, you know, processed types of foods.
Yeah, or boxed foods, you know, for example. Yeah, that's really interesting. I've never thought about that, but that is very true. And I love the analogy, the outside aisles. I'm going to use that with my patients.
Yeah, it's I guess because that's where the refrigerated section are and things have to be, you know, kept fresh that way.
Yeah, by the walls. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. So, okay, good. Okay, so let me do this. Let me take one more commercial break, and then we're going to come back, and we're going to start talking about some treatment options. So we'll be right back after this commercial.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
Good. Okay, we're back on Sleep Science Today. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky. We're talking with Dr. Tina Bhutani. We've been talking about dermatology and sleep and the relationship between the two. So it's pretty clear by now that inflammatory skin diseases have apparently a relation to whether we have good or bad sleep. There's so many different reasons that our sleep might be impacted. It could be because we have a bed partner who's not compatible. It could be because we have obstructive sleep apnea. It could be a whole host of things. But the point is, whatever our sleep issue is, we always want to see if we can improve it so that we can get restful sleep. But let's say patient comes in, they've got psoriasis, they've got eczema, they've got some inflammatory skin disease. Let's put sleep aside for a minute. What type of treatments are available for those, if any? Because I've heard some of them are very difficult to treat.
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely true that many skin diseases are difficult to treat. But, you know, we're in this new world. In the last, 5 to 10 years, I think, in dermatology, there has been an increased understanding of, again, as I mentioned, those immune pathways that are involved in these different diseases. And once we understand those, then, you know, we can start to develop drugs that specifically target those immune pathways. So now we actually have many treatments for psoriasis and eczema. And so, you know, I always encourage my patients. Some patients will be like, you know, I used to see a dermatologist 10 years ago. All they were able to give me were creams and they never really worked. So I just stopped going. And so I try to really encourage patients to come back to the clinic because the conversations we have now, 10 years later, are so much different than the conversations we had previously. So, you know, not only do we have newer topicals that work better in many cases, but we have pills, we have injections, we have light therapy, we have lots of different things that we can treat our patients with. Now, we're lucky in psoriasis and eczema. There are, you know, other inflammatory conditions where we, you know, might not have necessarily FDA-approved drugs just yet. But as dermatologists, one thing that we're not afraid of is to use things off-label. And the reason for that is because for many years in dermatology, you know, people thought these skin diseases were just cosmetic and like no pharmaceutical companies were investing in creating drugs for things that they just thought was a cosmetic problem. But when we started to realize that, for example, you know, psoriasis is a great example, you know, when it is a disease of systemic inflammation, it's not just a cosmetic concern. That's when I think, you know, people started to get on board and think about, you know, that these diseases could be treated more systemically. And so, you know, for many years, we had to use a lot of treatments that weren't necessarily indicated for psoriasis, but we knew that, you know, they were immune mediated, and so they might work. And so we've been using drugs off label for many years. And the same thing is for some of these less common inflammatory skin conditions. We kind of understand the pathways, so we can kind of take some of the drugs we have from other conditions and slot them in there. So.
Interesting. Yeah. So for, I'm going to group them together, and maybe I shouldn't, but psoriasis and eczema, are the treatment methodologies similar? And if they are, what do you start? Do you start with a cream? Do you start with a pill? What do you start with and where do you go?
Yeah, no. So psoriasis and eczema, two completely different kind of immune pathways that are involved. So, you know, we have pills for psoriasis, we have injections for psoriasis, creams for psoriasis, and then we have different ones for eczema. But we have options in both categories. But the commonalities that exist, really it comes down to, first of all, you know, how bad is someone's skin disease? And so, you know, is it just limited? Is it small, just patches on the skin where I think, you know, using a cream a couple times a day for a few weeks might clear it up and then they'll be good? Or do they walk into my, you know, clinic with head to toe kind of covered, just terrible rashes? And so that might manipulate, you know, the decision for what type of treatment I offer. Do I just offer a cream, or do I kind of offer them the pill or the injections that is going to treat their whole body? But, you know, we're also learning that it's not always about the amount of skin that's involved, you know. So, for example, patients might just have limited areas. Let's say they have psoriasis just on their hands, for example. So I can look at it and say, that's not a lot of skin. I can treat that with a cream and that'll be good. But that amount of skin has such a great impact on that patient's quality of life because it affects everything they're doing, you know, shaking hands, touching things, you know. that if there's enough impact on quality of life, even if it's a limited amount of skin involvement, we will start to think about that systemic treatment, so the pills and injections. And that has been a change in our practice, I think, also in the last few years, is really recognizing that it's not just all about the skin involvement, but really the impact that it has on a patient's quality of life. Similarly with eczema, you know, they might just have a little few patches of skin, but if they're very itchy and they're not sleeping well at night, and then that's kind of affecting their entire life, then I need to kind of be a little bit more aggressive with my treatment.
Right, right. So, you know, one of the things you had mentioned when we were talking about treatments was light therapy. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious about that only because when we talk about sleep issues, there's a light therapy when someone has a circadian rhythm issue that they're, you know, because circadian rhythms are based upon your light.
Yeah.
And the typical pathways, you know, rhythms throughout the day. So when you talk about light therapy as it relates to dermatology, what is light therapy?
Yeah, so light therapy is also known as phototherapy, and it's really the use of specialized UVB lamps. So we've taken the wavelengths of UVB that are not dangerous, so they're not the ones that cause skin cancer, for example, but they're the rays of lights that decrease inflammation. And I think we can all relate, you know, a lot of people say they go out in the sun and, you know, yeah, they might get sunburned, but their skin kind of feels a little bit better sometimes. And that's why you have people that want to get more sunlight. And so there are parts of UVB that can be good. And so we harness those into bulbs, and we have boxes in my clinic, for example, where patients come in 2 to 3 times a week and they get this special light shined on their skin. And it's a really natural way of treating inflammatory skin diseases.
So it's designed to reduce the inflammation.
Yeah.
I'm trying to get my head around that.
I know. And you know, to be completely honest, heliotherapy or the use of sunlight for treating skin diseases has actually been used since like the ancient Egyptians. Like there's hieroglyphics in Egypt which show people using sun to treat skin diseases. And we still utilize it, but we don't actually know the exact mechanisms by which how that sunlight kind of decreases inflammation. It's very interesting, but it helps with psoriasis, eczema, many other inflammatory skin conditions.
Mm-hmm. So that raises another question for me that I think is an important one to ask. So, you know, we're talking about the intersection here of sleep and skin care. Mm-hmm. And so with sleep, typically you want someone, when they wake up in the morning, you want people to be on a regular sleep wake schedule. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we will say to them, when you wake up in the morning, you want to open up your blinds, open up your windows, go outside. You want to get that sunlight, because the sunlight is going to wake you up. It impacts the circadian rhythm, all the things we were talking about just a little while ago. And while it is very helpful for a sleep perspective, I can imagine there's some dermatologists who are cringing when I say, go out and get the sun. So what's the right balance? What can a person do to protect their skin but still get the sunlight?
I know. It's a really fascinating question because, you know, obviously as dermatologists, we know that too much sun is not good for your skin, and potentially even kind of chronic levels of just low exposure sun. So it might not even be too much sun, just like getting a little bit of sun, but for many, many years can kind of cumulatively lead to damage that can cause skin cancers. And so, but there's also studies that show, for example, that patients who don't get enough sunlight, you know, have higher rates of mental health disorders and, you know, just might not feel as fulfilled and maybe have these, you know, circadian rhythm disorders. And so so I do think it's a very difficult question. So for my patients, you know, I always say I always want them to be wearing sunscreen, because no sunscreen is perfect, and you're actually going to still be able to get some UV rays even through the most, you know, protective sunscreen. There's not like a sunscreen that blocks out 100% of UV rays. So I think you're still going to get enough of benefits from the sunlight if you're wearing sunscreen. If you want to, you know, get sun exposure without sunscreen, if that's something that you think you really want to do, then I would try to avoid the, you know, times of the afternoon, probably between 12 and 3 p.m. when we know that the UV rays are the strongest and they're going to penetrate through your skin the deepest. So I think that early morning sun, for example, could be okay, as long as they're not getting burned, as long as you're not noticing any redness on your skin when you come back inside. So a few minutes of sun just to kind of wake up your circadian rhythms is probably okay. But again, you know, if you were to put on sunscreen, it's even better because you're kind of getting the best of both worlds.
Okay. And I can certainly, you know, appreciate that. So sunscreen, you know, a plus, it's probably going to, well, it will help protect your skin, but it's still going to let you get the sun that you need from a sleep perspective. Yeah. So yeah. Then that raises the question, if we talk about sunscreen, two questions. Number one, what percent? And number two, are there particular ingredients that people want to either look for or avoid when they're looking for a good sunscreen?
Yeah, great question. So my rule of thumb is at least SPF 30 for the face and at least SPF 50 for the body. That's at a minimum. If you are in a job where you sweat a lot, or you're on vacation where you're going to be, you know, in and out of the water and things like that, then you probably want to increase the SPF numbers. But for like a regular day-to-day, 30 for the face, 50 for the body is probably adequate for most people. And then the types of sunscreens, you know, we have both chemical sunscreens and we have mineral-based sunscreens, which use things like zinc and titanium dioxide. I think overall, you'll talk to dermatologists, and most dermatologists tend to lean towards the mineral sunscreens. We think that those are a little bit more natural, do a little bit better job of blocking out the sunlight. But they're also the ones that sometimes are kind of like the white and pasty sunscreen. And so it might be difficult for someone to use. Now, technology has gotten much better, and we actually have amazing mineral sunscreens now that actually aren't white and pasty. So, again, one of those things, if somebody's not using sunscreen because they have this memory of just being like, you know, white at the beach, that is not the case anymore. Now, chemical sunscreens are still out there. You know, there's some controversy. Some people feel that, you know, maybe chronic use of chemical sunscreens could have a negative impact. But the reality is that our studies so far are not really robust. And there's studies ongoing that I think are going to tell us a lot more about chemical sunscreens. But at this point, the data we have, we don't think they're unsafe. So if you like the feel of that chemical sunscreen, the way it feels, that it rubs in a little bit better, then you know, it's still safe to use them as far as we know.
Mm-hmm. So between the two, for someone like me, if I try and put sunscreen on my face, I tend to have oily skin and I sweat. So eventually it starts to like drip into my eyes and then burns my eyes. Which one of the types would be best for me to look at in that case?
Yeah, probably the mineral-based ones, because likely what's causing some of the burning is maybe the chemicals that are, you know, in that chemical sunscreen. And so, yeah, using something with either zinc or titanium dioxide as the active ingredients might be something to look into.
Fantastic, fantastic. Well, we are out of time for the day, and I appreciate all this information. It was interesting for me to be able to have this particular show because I never thought before about the you know, connection between dermatology and sleep, and I'm glad we had an opportunity to talk about it. So I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky. This is Sleep Science Today. I want to encourage you, if you're listening, to go to sleepsciencetoday.com where you can sign up to join our mailing list, get our newsletter, and you can get special offers there. Also, check out my new book, Why Can't I Sleep Well? It's also available at the website. And if you're in San Francisco, you can visit Dr. Tina Bhutani at the Synergy Dermatology. So, Dr. Bhutani, thank you so much for your time today and for sharing all this information.
I appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to Sleep Science Today and learning how to sleep better with your host, Andrew Kolsky, on UK Health Radio. For more information on how you can achieve better sleep, go to sleepsciencetoday.com. Remember, sleep science today and sleep better tonight.